Your icebox is bare. Beat the ribs. Show your stomach you care. Beat the ribs. Pull the rib chest of the power. I think it's a shame. Swearing out the lava, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of living it loud. Best to get. Beat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the ribs.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Now don't you think that that's rude? Storm, eat the ribs.
The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the station management here at KUCI. Today, we're going to continue our look at the protests over in Los Angeles against the Democratic Party convention. Outside the stadium, the Staples Center last night, there was a police melee. And with us on the phone is Carol Sobo, the attorney for the protesters. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. What happened last night?
Well, there was a rally outside Staples Center. It was a large D2K LA rally. It was a lot of groups participating. There was a small group of people over at the south end of the area. And I should say this is a group that probably 10,000 people there, 9,000-10,000 people. But there was a small group at the end who were, you know, throwing little rocks and plastic bottles at the police in riot gear over the fence for a lot of the time, but you know they were a handful. They were maybe like, you know, 15 people out of 10,000 people. The Rage Against the Machine played. It went off without any events. People were terrific. They listened to speeches from Dolores Huerta, from Jim Lawson, from Margaret Prescott, and they, you know, they responded to those speeches. They cheered. And Os Lamato was playing, and at that point, the police decided, you know, that they needed to step up their action involving the people who were throwing the rocks. Anyway, to make a long story short, at about 8 o'clock, one of the organizers of the rally and myself went to the police and said, we're going to ask people to leave soon. We're going to play one more song and samba them out of here and tell them to come back tomorrow and engage in the protests again tomorrow, engage in their free speech rights. And the police said, fine, that's okay. And then within like 2 minutes of that, they went in and pulled the plug on the event. So no one got to make the announcement. They pulled the plug. They couldn't even make their own order to disperse. And, of course, it was, you know, it was done in sort of the abrupt fashion that then made people angry. There still was not a problem from this crowd. The police ordered them to disperse. People were moving out of the facility. But they had done something in the morning that we had told them was going to be a problem, and they knew it. For the Mumia March on Sunday, there were no barriers around the protest site. And when we had met with the fire department before the convention in trying to resolve one of the federal lawsuits we filed, the fire department had said they wanted no blockades. They wanted people to be able to exit so that there wouldn't be a problem. On Monday morning, when people showed up to look at the site and get everything ready for the rally, there were these barriers that were set across the Olympic exit and on part of Figueroa.
These were concrete barriers.
Concrete barriers.
Yeah.
So that meant that when people went to leave after they get their dispersal order, people couldn't get out as quickly as they ordinarily might because people couldn't see the barriers when they got to them. They were walking. People were tripping on the barriers. So people were leaving, and I would say the bulk of the people had left at this point, at about 8:20, and all of a sudden the police opened up fire, and they were shooting rubber bullets at the crowd. Well, they shot at the people as they were leaving on Olympic and walking out. The natural instinct of people when you're being shot at is to turn and run. The only place to turn and run was to run back into the rally site. When they turned and ran back into the rally site, they were confronted with dozens and dozens of horses, police on horses and with batons, who were striking the people to move out of the way and using the horses to push people out of the way. There was no place people could run. On one side was shooting, at the other side they had the horses.
So they also shot pepper spray, right?
They shot pepper spray. They said they did targeted pepper spray at some people. I did not, personally, I did not see the pepper spray.
Some accounts said that that was the two anarchists that were on the fence. Suppose anarchists that put up a black flag.
Well, you know, every time someone puts a black flag or wears black clothing now, they're an anarchist. But they were, you know, as I said, they were, you know, 15 of the 10,000 people that were there.
Right, right. So you think they overreacted?
I think clearly they overreacted.
And you were hit with a rubber bullet, right?
But I was hit with a rubber bullet, but I was hit back at Olympic in Albany. And I was a block away from where the police were. When the demonstrators, there was a very small group of demonstrators with an American flag who came this way on Olympic. There really weren't very many people. And a bunch of the legal observers went out to stand between the police and the demonstrators, thinking that it would diffuse the situation and at least would protect the demonstrators from being clubbed. Their presence would prevent the police from engaging in more extreme tactics. And then the police started firing on the group itself.
Did they?
And I thought, okay, I'm a block away, and I'll be fine.
Yeah. Did they shoot right at the crowd or just on the ground to ricochet off the ground?
I don't know, because I was a block away. Either way, it's dangerous. Because I certainly think that I got hit by something that ricocheted.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, other people were getting hit. Jim Lafferty got hit in the head, but he put up his pad quickly, and so it deflected it, and he got hit in the leg as well.
Wow.
But, you know, people were, it was just indiscriminate. The firing was indiscriminate, which was dangerous, particularly because, you know, the overwhelming majority of the people who were there for peaceful means.
They were listening to the Rage Against the Machine concert.
They were listening to Rage Against the Machine, but they had marched. Yet, more than half of the people that were there had marched in the D2K LA protest rally. Oh. They had assembled and marched down from Pershing Square, so they were there for those political activities.
How did it hurt? Did it hurt? When you were hit?
Yeah, it hurt.
Yeah.
I was frankly stunned when I got hit. Originally, I was on the phone with Bob Myers, who was asking me to make a phone call, and I couldn't hear him. I just was so stunned, and I just said, Bob, I think I have to hang up now. I don't think I can talk to you. I think I just got hit in the head with something, and I could feel instantly
you were hit
my
on the,
head.
On the head?
I was hit right between the eyes.
Oh, my God. Is there a mark on your face?
There's a mark on my face. It's still swollen, although it was much more swollen last night. It was probably about an inch and a half or 2 inches, you know, around. It was like a, you know, goose egg on my head. And there's, you know, there's broken blood vessels and things because there's I'm developing two black eyes, frankly.
Wow.
You know, so I got hit right above the bridge of my nose. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, a half an inch either way, and I would have lost an eye.
Yeah, yeah.
Or seriously had damaged an eye.
So are you gonna file a lawsuit or what do you think's
happening? I have no idea what we're gonna do at this point. There are a lot of people who were injured, people who were injured much more seriously than I was. One woman at the press conference we held today had extraordinary welts on her back. And she was doing nothing more subversive than buying a hot dog at a restaurant that was on that corner.
Yeah, yeah. How about the homeless advocate, Mr. Hayes?
Ted Hayes. Ted Hayes got hit by a beanbag. I think he's okay now. He was taken to the hospital, and I think he'll, you know, I think that he's doing okay and he'll be okay. But he was engaged in, he was not there at the Staples Center. He was engaged in a lawful, permitted demonstration, walking on the sidewalk of Olympic Boulevard, carrying an American flag.
That's very subversive.
Yeah.
How about, do you think this violates the injunction that the judge laid down?
I don't think it relates to that injunction. I think what we're looking at is it may violate the terms of a settlement agreement we reached a number of years ago with the city in a case actually filed. The lead plaintiff is an Orange County resident, Marilyn Vassos, after the King verdicts. So we negotiated with the city a new crowd control manual, and we think that what they did last night violated that crowd control manual.
How do you spell her last name?
V-A-S-S-O-S.
O-S-O. And so...
S-S-O-S, yeah.
Yeah. And you're the lead... Are you the plaintiff? I mean, the lawyer for the plaintiffs in the over the injunction to stop...
I am one of the lawyers on each of... There are two injunction cases, and I'm one of the lawyers in that case, along with Dan Takagi of the ACLU and Robert Myers of the National Lawyer Guild.
So are they... Do you think that without the injunction, they would have even gone further?
Well, I think... We certainly think that. We think that the cautions from the federal court and the affirmation of demonstrators' rights from the federal courts were important. Now, you know, another thing that happened last night, not only were the barriers there that should not have been there and that created real problems, but shortly before the police broke up the rally, they had confiscated the puppets. You know, one of the things we didn't get the injunction for was to protect the puppets at the Convergence Center.
Right.
Well, people had used the puppets as part of the demonstration march and had them on the ground. They had the puppet pieces lying on the ground.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, people turned around and the police were picking up the puppets and carting them away.
So that was, they were supposed, not supposed to confiscate puppets, right?
Well, they were not supposed to confiscate puppets at the Convergence Center, but they were not supposed to confiscate puppets anywhere unless they had, they have no basis for confiscating the puppets unless they have reasonable cause to believe that the puppets are part of criminal activity. This is a threatened crime.
Right.
That certainly wasn't the case here. And who knows why they were confiscating the puppets, but of course it set people off.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it just is one of those tension-provoking situations.
All the news accounts I've seen highlight this anarchist stuff. Do you think they're getting a bad rap or what?
Well, you know, I think the anarchist issue is a red herring, to excuse the expression. You know, and it sort of is a buzzword. We've come full circle in a century. We began the century with attacks on anarchists, then we went to communists, then we went to terrorists, now we're back to anarchists again. All I know is that the anarchist convention was a non-event. I mean, it was just not the threat that the police had hyped it up to be, showing videotapes of Eugene, Oregon, and saying, this is what happens when you have an anarchist convention. They take to the streets. They destroy the streets. You know, and they had an anarchist convention here in Los Angeles for 3 days before the demonstrations began around the Democratic Convention, and there was simply nothing that happened. I don't know if the people who were engaged in you know, the rock throwing and things at this march last night, as I said, who were, you know, 12 out of 10,000 people. I don't know if they were anarchists or not. I don't think they did anything different. If they were anarchists, they didn't do anything much different from what the people at the Staples demonstration, at the Lakers demonstration did, Lakers celebration.
But do you think that's the main reason that they cleared the square, I guess? Because they didn't want a repeat of the Lakers riot, I guess?
I don't know. You know, I think that the police in this city are somewhat... I think this was retaliation. I think they want to show that that they are necessary to maintain order in this city, which they are to a certain extent, but that they... That, you know, this is sort of in retaliation for getting the two court orders and for doing all that. You know, they... I just think this is a flex of the LAPD's muscle.
So they're trying to show they're in control.
I think they're trying to show they're in control, and quite frankly, I think that they chose to do what they did when they did it because they wanted the demonstrators out of the way before the delegates came out from the convention center.
Right. By the time they came out, there was all clear.
They held the delegates inside.
All
friends
right.
of mine who were delegates said they held them inside, and even earlier in the day, they would not let the delegates out into the area. They told them it was going to be too dangerous for that. So clearly, they knew what they were going to do, but they held the delegates inside. When my friends attempted to get to their bus, they said every time they went a block or two, they came up against other police officers who sent them in another direction, told them they couldn't go where they were going. They said that their bus was like three blocks from the Staples Center, and they wound up walking total of about a mile and a half.
My God.
To get to their bus. I read the paper today. They chased Mark Green and others of the New York delegates down the street, you know, the liberal activists. I've heard other delegates say, oh, no, they were fine, and I'm sure they were very nice to the delegates, but Miguel Contreras, who's, you know, the head of the County Federation of Labor, got hassled, even though he said, I'm a delegate. People got chased and hassled no matter what.
Do you think this will repeat itself today and tomorrow or later?
Well, I hope it doesn't. I think that, you know, we're seeing some problems. We've been in touch with the city about what we consider to be some further violations of people's rights. But we're just going to, you know, we're going to monitor the situation and hope it does not repeat itself.
So you don't advise people to avoid the area? I mean, if they want to come down to protest.
No, I don't advise people to avoid the area. In fact, I think it would be a real loss if people did that. This is a once-in-40-year opportunity in Los Angeles to make your voices heard to the Democratic Party, to the political, the establishment political leadership of this country. And I don't think people should be intimidated into giving up that right because of the police's action or because of the hyperbole that the police put out. The police have, in some sense, I think, created a situation. They have promised people violence, and now they feel like they must deliver.
How about tomorrow, the march to the Parker Center? Do you think that would be dangerous?
Well, I don't understand why the march to the Parker Center should be dangerous. We've had other marches to Parker Center in the city. What I think is going to be a problem is I would expect the police to be out in their riot gear. The last time we had a major demonstration at Parker Center was the removal of Daryl Gates after the Rodney King verdict. And the only problem at that particular demonstration was the appearance of Metro Division inside Parker Center in riot gear. Which I think was done to assert their presence and to try to intimidate demonstrators. So, you know, I think that the overwhelming number of people who are here to engage in political activity are here to do it lawfully.
So you're optimistic that the protesters will prevail?
Well, I'm hopeful that the protesters would prevail. I think the protesters have the Constitution on their side, but I'm always pessimistic about whether that will impact voluntarily the behavior of the Los Angeles Police Department, which thinks that it makes the law and that it is above the law.
And these attempts to reform it, I mean, I know there's an attempt to reform the police commission and the rules about, isn't there something going in the works right now?
Yes, there is. The Justice Department is engaged in negotiations with them about resolving, you know, reaching an agreement that will stave off a federal lawsuit and a consent decree to take over supervision of certain areas, not take over supervision, but to impose conditions and restrictions on what the Los Angeles Police Department can do in certain areas and trying to bring them into compliance with the law.
So you think this is because of all this that they haven't repeated what happened in Philadelphia, the preemptive strikes against the demonstrators?
Well, I think they haven't repeated what happened in Philadelphia because in this city the demonstrators did what the demonstrators did in no other city. The organizing committee went to court and got orders from the federal court, preventing them from doing in Los Angeles what they did in Philadelphia and Washington.
So that was a victory then,
It was an incredible victory, and I think all of the demonstrators would say that too. The leadership of the organizing committees firmly believed that had there not been the federal court stepping into this situation, they would not have the puppets, people would have been arrested, the Convergence Center would have been raided. And none of that has happened. And I should say another thing. The organizers have been extremely open. They have invited the press in to see what they were doing. The press were there while they were making the puppets. They saw them practice with the puppets. They saw them leave with the puppets. They were invited to come along with them at every opportunity. They're not engaged in illegal activity, and they have nothing to hide. And that was the message they wanted to send out.
But what happened at the Indy Media Center, Independent Media Center, yesterday? There was supposed to be a bomb threat, and they cleared one room or something, one floor.
I only know this stuff secondhand. But apparently, the sheriff's department, I believe it was, which is handling some of the activities for the police department responded and said that they said they thought there was a bomb in a car that was parked next to the transmitter for the free TV. And
right.
I understand it was hours before
they had to go off the air for a while. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And it also disrupted the shadow convention that was there, right? I think some of the people were outside, they said.
It may have. I think they cleared the building, yeah.
Oh, the floor, at least, yeah.
Yeah, the floor, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Carol.
You're welcome, Dan.
Okay, hang in there. Keep in touch. Bye-bye. Carol Sobel, an attorney for the plaintiffs of who are the protesters in Los Angeles, she herself was hit with a rubber bullet last night, and she personally was my lawyer when I sued the CIA over the spying on myself. Carol Sobel, the attorney that got the injunction in Los Angeles to stop the police from preemptively striking against the protesters. You're listening actually to Subversity here on KUCI with Dan Zhang. We're here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and on the web at kuci.org. We're going to continue with our look at the protests this week, and we're going to take a look back at events on Sunday when there was a rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal in Pershing Square and then a march from Pershing Square to the Staples Center. We're going to take a look at that and listen to some speeches and some interviews. But first we're going to play something from Mumia himself. Since this march was about him, it's appropriate to play what he had to say, or he has to say.
American mass media is a marvel of technology. It is whiz-bang, sparkle, glitter, and satellite wizardry. It is a master plan of methods to communicate in a pauper's worth of substance. With such technology, how are people so woefully misinformed? The average American neither knows nor cares about the vast world beyond the nation's border. The average American student knows little math, no history, and very little geography, and nor does he or she want to know. Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly. On November 2nd, 1995, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly, 117-3, to condemn the United States for its continuing blockade of Cuba. The international community called the United States blockade a flagrant act of aggression and a blatant violation of international law. That the UN vote was reported at all in American media is amazing, for such news is more often than not passed over entirely by the American press. But where was information about the blockade itself? The effects suffered by the Cuban people, in-depth comments from United Nations delegates and leaders around the world. For a more substantive report, one had to listen to the BBC World News Service, for the rest of the world takes note of events the US prefers to ignore. American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them. Every media enterprise in America reports the drivel that Marcia Clark and Chris Darden are secret lovebirds, but the vote of a global assembly condemning U.S. actions received only scant coverage at best. Why? The media is a source of titillation more than information. The mission of the media is to please, to comfort, and primarily to sell. When TV was developed, it was promised that every American would learn about the world in his living room. When computers were developed, wasn't it said that they would be invaluable learning tools and that children would learn more faster? National scholastic tests show otherwise, as kids master computers as toys and learn splendid hand-to-eye coordination, but little else. The media paints false pictures of the nation and the world, pictures designed to serve corporate masters and to make America look good. This feel-good media approach serves the American delusion of white supremacy, but it does not inform. When the New York Times echoes the National Star, what can the word media mean? How could millions be surprised at Minister Farrakhan's enormous influence among blacks unless the media wasn't doing its job? How could they look at a million and count less than half that number? The major media, like its racist projections, is to be rejected, not consumed, for your very patronage gives it life. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That was Mumia talking on his CD, All Things Considered. Today we're going to look back at the Mumia March back on Sunday in Los Angeles, where thousands of people gathered in Pershing Square and marched a few blocks, 10 blocks or so, to Staples Center. At the rally at Pershing Square, a number of people spoke about why they supported Mumia's fight. He's on death row. He's convicted of killing a policeman in Philadelphia, but evidence has come out that raised question about that conviction, and his supporters argue that he was wrongly convicted, and he is a political prisoner on death row. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, management, nor the regents of the University of California. We're going to listen to one of the speakers at the rally, who was Leonard Weinglass, Mumia's lead attorney, in his effort to get a fair trial, another trial, and to avoid the death penalty, the death sentence. Let's go to that.
This week, in the state of Texas,
I'm trying to keep you guys down.
The Republican presidential candidate George Bush oversaw the execution of Oliver Cruz, a mentally retarded man. And the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party had nothing to say about it. We're here today to tell them and the leadership of this country and the people of this country that we have, as a nation, become too desensitized to state killing, too desensitized to killing here in America, to killing in Iraq.
That's right.
And to killing in the many parts of the world.
American government financed all of them.
Power of
murder
the country
across the world.
Taking the lives of innocent people, poor people, and people of color.
That's right.
Woo!
Okay.
But we have to acknowledge that the United States kills not only the mentally retarded, and 35 have been killed in the last 25 years. The United States kills its young as well.
That's right.
On June 22nd, when Shaka Sankofa was executed in Texas, he was another juvenile offender, so-called. A man who was arrested when he was just 17 years old for a crime he did not commit, and he was executed just the same. In the last 2 years, the United States is the only country in the world to execute its children. There are five countries, just five, that allow for the execution of juveniles. Bangladesh, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and the United States. And the United States in the last 10 years has executed more than all the other five put together. We have to put a stop to this madness.
That's right!
There are 74 juvenile offenders out of the 3,600 on death row today waiting for execution. They must be saved as well. Not only the mentally retarded, the juveniles, We also execute those who were themselves victims, those who were sexually molested and physically abused as children. In a study released last year, over 90% of the 3,600 waiting execution were themselves people who were brutalized as youth and who should not be held accountable for acting out as older juveniles and as adults for the victimization that was visited upon them as children. We execute the poor. There are no millionaires on death row.
That's right.
We execute people of color. Just look at the city of Philadelphia, where according to a study that was released 2 years ago by Professor Baldus of Iowa, if you grow up young and black in Philadelphia, you are 11 and a half times more likely to end up on death row. And if you grow up young and black in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, or any of the five states of the Deep South, this is a deeply racist system that brings about the death penalty. There can be no doubt about it. Although you're all here for Mumia and here for everyone else on death row, we have to bear in mind that no one life on death row is worth more than any other life. Mumia's case, a political prisoner, a former member of the Black Panther Party, a writer, an award-winning journalist, and a critic of the police, has come to symbolize everything that's wrong on death row. But what he symbolizes also applies to the others. In his case, he had a lawyer who spoke to no witnesses, who was hopelessly unprepared. He had a judge who has put more people on death row than any sitting judge in the United States. He had witnesses against him who have since come forward and said they've lied. He had a witness in his favor who they prevented from testifying for him. And they prevented him from representing himself, and they used his politics as a young Black Panther against him to get the death penalty. This case should not stand, and with your help, it will not. You are not alone. Last month, the National Postal Workers Union passed a resolution calling for a new trial for Mumia. 2 weeks ago, SEIU and their national convention did the same. 2 years ago, the Longshoremen's Union here in California prevented, on Mumia's birthday, all ships from moving in and out of port on the West Coast. President Mandela, Bishop Tutu, Mrs. Mitterrand, 75 members of the Danish Parliament, 45 members of the Japanese Parliament, people from around the world, the teachers of Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro have called for strikes, all in favor of Mumia. Yeah. This case is pending in the federal court in Philadelphia. Within 2 months, we will have a hearing in that court. Mumia will be present. We will be asking this federal judge to reconsider Mumia's case, to hear the testimony of witnesses who were barred in his trial, to hear the testimony of witnesses who said they testified falsely. And we hope that at the end of this hearing, we will get for the first time in 18 years, for the first time we're before a judge who was not elected in Pennsylvania, for the first time we're before a court that is not part of the old boys network of the corrupt political system of Pennsylvania. We hope that we will get finally what we seek, and that is justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And with your help and the help of many people around the country and around the world, it will happen. Stay strong. Free Mumia.
That was Leonard Weinglass, the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking Sunday at a rally at Pershing Square in Los Angeles. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the web. We're going to listen to another excerpt from the CD that Mumia recorded, his thoughts on the death penalty.
That's what capital punishment really means. Those that ain't got the capital gets the punishment, is the old saying. Once again, we see the inherent truths that lie in the proverbs of the poor. That old saying echoed when it was announced that the District Attorney of Delaware County, Patrick Meehan, would not seek the death penalty in the case of John E. DuPont, the wealthy corporate heir charged with the shooting death of Olympic champion David Schultz. The Delaware County DA's office said no aggravated circumstances justifying the death sentence existed. Could it be that DuPont's personal wealth, estimated at over $400 million, was a factor? In one fell swoop, the state ensured that while millionaires may be murderers, they are not eligible for that preserve of the poor, America's death row. As the case of O.J. Simpson showed us, the state is very selective in who it chooses to include in its macabre club of death. O.J., a bona fide celebrity, corporate pitchman, sports legend, and millionaire, was deemed, even though a suspect in a double murder, not fit for a death sentence. So, whether or not one is of the opinion that Mr. Simpson was either innocent or guilty, the point remains that before the trial actually began, the DA of Los Angeles decided no death penalty for O.J. Millionaires need not apply. As it was for Mr. Simpson, so it was for Mr. DuPont. Simpson's wealth compared to DuPont's makes him look like a pauper. As for DuPont, consider, if you will, the incredible spectacle of the DA with all the identical facts announcing he or she would not be seeking the death penalty if DuPont was the victim. I'm sure we can all agree that would be impossible. Any poor man who slays a wealthy man will have the weight of the system fall on him like a ton of bricks. For a wealthy man, however, who finds himself charged with killing a poor man, the system becomes user-friendly. Why should this be so? It's because the system serves the interest of the wealthy. It is their system. In essence, when a poor person comes before the court, he or she faces two things, the offense and being poor. I am not suggesting that Mr. DuPont, or anyone else for that matter, should be sentenced to death. I'm just noting how and why the death sentence is reserved for some and off limits to others. The death sentence remains a prerogative of the poor. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Dan Zhang here with KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You're listening to Subversity here on KCI. We are bringing you an account of the Sunday's protests over Mumia's imprisonment and death row sentence. We're going to continue with that and bring you another excerpt from Mumia himself.
In the case known as Strickland versus Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court drastically narrowed the range of challenges to the effectiveness and competence of counsel at criminal trials. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides a right in all criminal cases to assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment notwithstanding, are people facing imprisonment and severe punishments actually receiving effective and competent assistance of counsel? You decide. If your lawyer actually went to sleep during your trial, would you think he or she was effective? This is what an appeals court ruled in a case called People versus Tippins, 1991. Although defense counsel slept during portions of the trial, the opinion read, counsel provided defendant meaningful representations. What about if your lawyer was high on drugs during the trial? When an appellate court was faced with just such an instance in the case known as People versus Badia, 1990, this was their learned analysis, quote, proof of a defense counsel's use of narcotics during a trial does not amount to a per se violation of constitutional right to effective counsel, unquote. Note, in this case, counsel admitted using heroin and cocaine throughout the trial. And in the case Commonwealth versus Africa, specifically involving MOVE political prisoner Mike Africa,
The trial lawyer later admitted to daily cocaine and marijuana use, but that issue wasn't raised on appeal. It would seem that a fairly competent lawyer, having researched the evidence, would pay some attention to how his client was dressed at trial. Not so, said a court of appeals in the case known as People v. Murphy, 1983. Quote, counsel's seeming indifference to defendant's attire, though defendant was wearing the same sweatshirt and footwear in court that he wore on the day of the crime, did not constitute ineffective assistance, unquote. In all of these real cases, the attorneys involved were deemed competent in their representations, and their clients' convictions were upheld. Under these cases, counsel means little more than presence by a lawyer at trial, for even if he is asleep, even if he or she is a drug addict, indeed high at the trial itself, it ain't no thing. Counsel, under Strickland's tortured logic, is presumed effective. This is just a few of the many cases from across the United States that show the poverty of the Sixth Amendment. For more information, you can read Effective Assistance Isn't Much, an article by Roger Darloff in the January-February issue of The American Lawyer. Increasingly, the amendments to the U.S. Constitution are merely filler for dusty history books which have no application in real life, as the courts have shown repeatedly. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We got a chance to talk with Mumia's attorney, Leonard Weinglass, and here's what he had to say.
Are you hopeful about the court case coming up?
I'm hopeful about Mumia's case because I find that his support, both nationally and internationally, is growing. And if this support continues to grow, well, then I think the courts are going to be forced to look at his case for the first time, objectively and with a sense of justice. If we've compelled them to do that, then I think there's no question but that on the law and on the facts, Mumia will win his case.
Is it the same judge, though, that's hearing?
No, for the first time, we're before a judge who is not elected, who is not part of the Pennsylvania establishment. We're before an independent federal judge. That's a hopeful development.
What do you think of last week's developments when they took people off the street and did all the preemptive kind of detention?
Philadelphia?
Yeah, you wouldn't think they would be allowed to do that in this country.
Philadelphia is a city of tough justice. They have a long history, and it's a very bad history.
Well, Frank Rizzo.
Yes, it's still Rizzo's town. Rizzo's gone, but the Rizzo spirit is still very much there in Philadelphia.
It's a scary.
It is a scary place.
Do you think they're going to do the same here?
Not sure. Los Angeles is tough also. It's interesting that of all the locations in the United States where conventions could be held, they picked the two cities where the police departments have the worst reputation.
Right, definitely.
And it remains to be seen what happens in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, Leonard Weinglass. We're gonna continue with this show focusing on the Mumia March, and have a listen to what one of Mumia's family members had to say. And this is a talk given by Mumia's son at the rally when the marchers reached Staples Center outside where the Democratic Party convention was set to begin the next day. And this was on Sunday when Masi Abu-Jamal spoke at the rally. So here's a chance to listen to what Mumia's son had to say.
Thank you.
sound of the crowd.
All right. Now, you know what this government is capable of when they killed Gary Graham, when they executed him after all of the evidence that came, and the corporate media even said that this man was innocent, and they still executed him. So we know what cruelness, what kind of hearts did they have. What kind of heart do you have to not allow a father to touch his son? The pain that's there. But there is a son, Mumia's son, is still strong. He's still fighting back. And he was here to tell you about that fight back. He was in Cuba to tell them about the fight back. And he's here to inspire us to fight on.
Mazi Jamal has a special message from his father. Mazi, would you come forward, please?
Buenos dias, LA. Before I read my father's statement, I'm just going to say something from my own heart. It's really wonderful to see so many people out here today of so many ages, so many classes, so many colors out here defending my father's right to exist. And I mean, there are no words I have that, you know, can thank you enough for coming out here today.
Here we go.
We stand here at the dawning of a new millennium, where we have so designed to keep people like you and me behind bars and unable to exercise our voices to defend ourselves and our children. It is up to each and every one of you out here to stand up and defend yourself and your families from the new internment of America. Because right now we keep 2 million people, 2 million of your brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and sons behind bars, and that's unacceptable. And these fat cats in here, they can hear your voices when you shout. They absolutely can. And they know. They know that when you're out here exercising your rights, that their days in power are numbered. And now this is my father's statement. On a move. Long live John Africa. The LA convention is but an echo of the recent convention in Philadelphia. It is a convention bought and paid for by corporate capital. It is a convention of the well-to-do and wealthy, not of the workers of the poor. And Philadelphia shows us that politicians are nothing but public relations spokesmen for their bosses. Whether one votes for the Democrats or Republicans, ultimately, one votes for their own repression. The prisons that dot our landscape, 2 million men, women, and children held in American jails and prisons, the 3,600 men, women, and juveniles facing the death at the hands of the state, are each and all the political result of the politics of oppression, estrangement, of separation, and of isolation. We are not used to seeing politicians, or for that matter, police, as tools and instruments of political ill will, but they are that. We need to think outside the box of the two-headed dog of American politics. Why not a party of those who labor? Why not a party of those which includes the interests of youth, mothers, students, or the growing poor? You will see none of these interests represented on the stages of the two-party system. And I say, isn't it time to create an alternative? Because both parties are parties of death, of war, of alienation, and of unending conflict. Why not a party of peace and justice? Of life and our common humanity? Why not a party that speaks to our highest hopes instead of our darkest fears? The need for change was never more obvious than now. To quote John Africa one more time,
Revolution means change. Revolution is doing it, or it ain't getting done.
Let's do it, on the move. On my love.
Freedom Rule 9. Long live South Africa. Free my father.
Thank you, Brent.
That was Masih Abu-Jamal talking about his father's case at a rally at outside Staples Center on Sunday as the protest marches reached the Staples Center from Pershing Square. This is Subversity here on KCI. We're continuing with our look at the Democratic Party protests, convention protests in Los Angeles this week. Coming up tomorrow, tonight, there'll be some marches from a group of queers and allies, calling themselves Queer and Allies, protesting the policies of the Clinton-Gore administration towards gay people. And that's actually happening at 6 o'clock tonight in Los Angeles. And then tomorrow there'll be a whole day of protests over the criminalization of youth and the criminalization of the criminal injustice system. There'll be a rally at noon and a march at 2 o'clock to Staples Center, which is to Parker Center, which is the head of the police department, the headquarters of the LAPD. And at 4 o'clock, the Youth Coalition, the people of youth, young people will be marching back to the Staples Center, from Parker Center. So tomorrow is a big focus on youth and on the criminalization of the criminal injustice system, which is part and parcel of the war on the poor. And here's what Mumia had to say about the war on the poor.
In every phase and facet of national life, there's a war being waged on America's poor. In social policy, poor mothers are targeted for criminal sanctions for acts, if committed by mothers of higher economic class, would merit treatment at the Betty Ford Center. In youth policy, governments hasten to close schools while building boot camps and prisons as their graduate schools. Xenophobic politicians hoist campaigns to the dark star of imprisonment for street beggars, further fattening the fortress economy. The only apparent solution to the scourge of homelessness is to build more and more prisons. In America's 90s, to be poor is not so much socioeconomic status as it is a serious character flaw, a defect of the spirit. Federal statistics tell a tale of loss and want so dreadful that Dickens, of A Tale of Two Cities fame, would cringe. Consider 7 million people homeless, with less than $200 in monthly income. 37 million people, 14.5% of the nation's population, living below poverty levels. Of that number, 29% are African Americans, meaning over 10.6 million blacks living in poverty. Both wings of the ruling Republican Party try to outdo themselves in announcing new, ever more draconian measures to restrict, redress, restrain, and to eliminate the poor. One is reminded of the wry observation of French writer Anatole France: the law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Already, U.S. manufacturers have fled to NAFTA-friendly Mexico, and only the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas has slowed an emerging flood of Western capital. Outgunned in the industrial wars by Japan and Germany, the U.S. has embarked on a low-technology, low-skilled, high-employment scheme that exploits the poor, the stupid, and the slow via a boom in prison construction, America's sole growth industry. Increasingly, more and more Americans are guarding more and more American prisoners for more and more years, and this amidst the lowest crime rate in decades. No major political party has an answer to this social dilemma, short of cages and graves for the poor. The time is ripe for a new, brighter, life-affirming vision that liberates, not represses, the poor who, after all, are the vast majority of this earth's people. Neither serpentine politics nor sterile economic theory, which treats them, people, as mere economic units, offer much hope, for the very politicians they vote for spit in their faces, while economists write them off as non-persons. It must come from the poor, a rebellion of the spirit that reaffirms their intrinsic human worth based upon who they are rather than what they possess. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We're now going to bring you the music that closed the rally at Pershing Square of Sister Negus Samaya of the band Revolutionary Change.
Thank you.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Di Chapman, High Visibility. Listen to Alternative News on Friday at 5 o'clock for an update on the protest. This is Dan Song signing off for Subversity.
Sin pigs roar, hey, sin pigs roar.